Welcome back. Let's Get Physical Therapy is an educational podcast brought to you by MedStar Health and hosted by me, physical therapist Becca Schumer. I will be sharing the mic with tons of healthcare professionals with the goal of educating and inspiring fellow PTs and future PTs. We hope you find this both informative and inspirational, ultimately optimizing how we treat our patients and grow as professionals. Please enjoy today's episode. Today, I am stoked to interview Dr. Hinton on the podcast. He is the medical director of MedStar Sports Medicine and the division director for sports medicine, MedStar Union Memorial Hospital. Dr. Hinton's practice is concentrated on knee and shoulder conditions and involves athletes at the recreational, scholastic, collegiate, and professional levels of play. Dr. Hinton has served as a team physician for the Baltimore Ravens, Towson University, Loyola University, Oregon State University, the U.S. national teams, lacrosse, and a number of scholastic and youth organizations. He is co-chair of the NFL's Research and Innovations Committee, one of 14 members of the NFL's Health and Safety Oversight Committee, and is an executive member of U.S. Lacrosse's Sports Science and Safety Committee. He is the director of the nation's leading lacrosse-specific sports medicine program located at USA Lacrosse and MedStar Health. He has served as a president of the Maryland's Orthopedic Association, held membership on the various AOSSM committees, and served on the Maryland Board of Physicians Athletic Trainers Oversight Committee. He is frequently invited to speak at regional and national medical meetings, as well as public conferences focused on youth sports medicine. I am so, so excited to host Dr. Hinton today. He has been a mentor of mine for pretty much all of my career. He is a wealth of knowledge. We unfortunately couldn't get into detail on everything that we wanted to talk about because this podcast would be 3 hours long. But let's dive into the podcast and hear from Dr. Hinton.
Yep.
Dr. Hinton, welcome to the podcast.
Happy to be here. Looking forward to it, Becca. Thanks.
Fresh out of the OR. Here you are.
Yeah, well, it was a good day. So in between OR and meetings. So I've been looking forward to this. So thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You know, I don't know if you've listened to many of our podcast episodes, but we'd love to hear your journey. How did you get into the field that you're currently working in?
Ooh, it's been a circuitous route. So I've been very fortunate. I've been a lot of things in addition to what I am now, and I hope to be a lot of other things before I leave. I grew up in a really small town out in eastern North Carolina, 300 people in the town. It was the biggest town in my whole county, Gatesville, North Carolina. And I was lucky growing up in North Carolina when at that time UNC's mission was really to educate the top five kids in every public high school in the state. So it changed my life being able to go to Chapel Hill from where I was. I went to theater school there originally, and then I went up to the University of Virginia to a very interesting program where you could get your master's in athletic training and collect your master's in education from the Curry School of Education. My college roommate at Chapel Hill was a lacrosse player from Baltimore, which is one of the avenues that I took to have been involved. We grew up together and have been best friends for nearly 50 years. And he was CEO and president of U.S. Lacrosse for 30 years. And I've been a successful orthopedic surgeon. And if you'd met us both in 1977, you might not have betted on that. But anyway, so I went up to UVA and I was got my master's in athletic training. I came up to Baltimore and I worked for 4 years as a PT and ATC. And I played rugby with some great people, orthopedic surgeons, general surgeons, physical therapists, and they sort of put in front of me, had I ever thought about going to medical school? And I really hadn't. I enjoyed what I was doing. Hopkins, interestingly, at the time, did not require the MCATs. So I applied to Hopkins. I applied to one medical school, and I had some good support, and I was very lucky at getting in, and I just had a wonderful time. Smart people every day from all around the world. I did medical school, and then I did my orthopedic residency in here in Baltimore. I did a pediatric fellowship with Paul Sponseller at Hopkins, was very interested in peds and sports. And I then did a fellowship in sports medicine at Union Memorial MedStar. And I had some dear friends that I had met in medical school that were working in the School of Public Health at Hopkins doing the very initial research on like crash test dummies for auto accidents, and also working in the realm of handgun violence and handgun modification and legislation. And I looked at what they were doing in public health, and I said, well, man, you can apply all of that to sports medicine and orthopedics. So I went back and did a master's in public health, and it's the best year I've spent. My research interest and most of my interest has really been in organizational partnerships, in policy and injury prevention, injury epidemiology. My clinical practice is primarily knee and shoulder surgery with a subspecialty in pediatric and adolescent athletes. So I've been very lucky. So
I don't know if you know that I call you this behind your back, but I'm going to tell you today, I call you the most interesting man in the world.
Oh, well, good. I just need to be a little more Mexican with my look and let my goatee grow a little more. Maybe I'll try for that advertisement. So
no, but truly, it's unbelievable what you've accomplished in your career. And you're in a band. You sing in a band. What can't you do? What can't you do?
Well, I mean, that's kind of an interesting thing, too. I mean, the whole music thing is a community-oriented nonprofit. And the music that we write and do really tries to encourage people to get up and do things on their own, to find joy in their lives through their own hands and not always spectating. And it's interesting, although I've spent my entire life in sports medicine, I'm very much an advocate for fitness and sport, particularly in youth and teaching young people teamwork and how to be on the field and a team with people that don't look like them, that are sometimes better and sometimes lesser in different ways in life, but to get along. But I'm not a big spectator of sport. I enjoy getting out doing things. I'm lucky at hiking around the world in different places now, as you do. And I think we find some of the same joy in that. So it's been a great run. And like I say, I don't know what's around the corner. I'm very interested now in this intersection of culture and sport. We have this lecture series, Sports Agora, that's specifically about where medicine and culture and health and sports meet. And as you know, you spend your life, and with this podcast, I'm sure you're touching on it. Sport in America touches so many places that if you are working in sport, you really have a license and a opportunity to speak to so many things, you know, where people spend their money, this balance of spectation and participation. Kids, again, what is it that we want young people getting out of sport? We've talked a lot about, you know, the club sport platform in America is just broken now, right? So if you're in sports, you have an avenue to make a difference in a lot of places.
I was going to say back a minute ago that I absolutely enjoy sharing pictures with you on all of our adventures that we go on.
No, they're
separate,
good.
It gets separate you adventures, added, but yeah.
Yeah, different places to, you know, to see things and also kind of trust yourself. You know, you get out, you do things, you kind of have to, it's a good place to learn to believe in yourself, put in the work, you feel good about it. And I think that's something, you know, you can celebrate that you're doing, you know?
Mm-hmm. So. Definitely. All right. So this is a lacrosse medicine series that we're doing. So sure. I would love to hear about our partnership with USA Lacrosse. I know you and Steve Sanderson might be a little more gray in the face, right. But right. Tell us how this kind of came to be and why is it so meaningful?
Well, I had to grow the gray beard because all of my partners are 10 years younger than me, but I look 10 years younger than them. So I've got the gray beard to sort of even that out. I don't know how much your listeners know about MedStar Sports Medicine or MedStar Health. MedStar Health's a $7 billion nonprofit, one of the biggest bed providers and comprehensive healthcare providers in America and the biggest in the central Mid-Atlantic. Sports medicine is a priority service line for MedStar Health. It is one of only two service lines that go across the entire Baltimore, Washington region in a coordinated fashion, cardiac services being the other. Our leadership has been very supportive and see sports medicine as the place that our healthcare system can meet people when they are healthy, to establish relationships with people that are surrounded about health, wellness, and education before they become sick or before they become injured. So we take care, we are one of only four systems in the country that take care of Major League Baseball, NFL, NHL, NBA, and women's basketball. Only one of only three that do all of those. We take care of 14 colleges and universities, but, and I have had the great pleasure of working in all of those environments, but I tell people, not just on this podcast, but everywhere I go, the MedStar U.S. lacrosse relationship is MedStar Sports Medicine at its best. Completely integrated organizationally over a 25-year period, starting with basic injury epidemiology research when there was none available. When we started with U.S. lacrosse in 1998, we did a PubMed search, and there were five articles in the world's literature dealing with lacrosse sports medicine. Now there are thousands and thousands. So we started with a research partnership that then grew into helping assist, administrate, and directly provide medical services for their national teams. It used to be that there were four national USA lacrosse teams, men's and women's field over 21, men's and women's field under 21. Now there are 12 national teams, including the disciplines of box lacrosse for men and women, field lacrosse for under 16 boys and girls, under 18 boys and girls. And then the most exciting thing now is the national teams for the small-sided game, or sixes. So sixes, this is very interesting. It will be an Olympic sport in LA in 2028. And there's a lot of interest that goes along with that. And sixes is a game that can be picked up in communities that have currently not played lacrosse. It does not take, it can be played as a non-contact sport. It can be played as a co-gender sport. And just like has been shown in hockey and soccer, small-sided play for kids is important because they get more touches, they have more fun, there's less standing around. So the game is growing there. So it was first research, then it was caring for national teams. And then about 10 years ago, U.S. Lacrosse was moving their headquarters from off the Johns Hopkins campus to a separate freestanding facility up in Sparks, Maryland. And we had the thought at that time of working with them to establish about 10,000 square feet in the center of their administrative headquarters that serves as performance, physical therapy, athletic training, physician space, research space. Out of that facility, we cover over 300 lacrosse-related events at the national headquarters every year, providing emergency action planning, providing direct physician, athletic training, physical therapy, and conditioning services. That's inclusive of national teams play, but also the very exciting Women's Athletes Unlimited professional league that is really tip of spear about women's professional sports, very unique, very interactive with audience, interactive with other players format for their season. So we now are really integrated at a level that we share some employee physicians. Some of our athletic trainers are reimbursed by USA Lacrosse and by MedStar. Same for some physician and conditioning services. But we are, U.S. Lacrosse, over this relationship, really looks at health and safety as one of the flags that they can fly that differentiates them from many other nonprofit sporting organizations of the same size. They also have a National Sports Science and Safety Committee, which MedStar has two permanent spots on. Just a wonderful cadre of people. Our past chair on that committee is the current chief medical officer for Major League Soccer, Margot Petukian. The current chief medical officer for World Lacrosse, Gene Hong, is a past executive member Karen Sutton up at HSS, one of the most recognizable faces today in sports medicine, is a past team physician and member. So we're integrated at a lot of different levels.
Yeah, it's pretty cool to work up there and see all these things happening together. And I imagine it wasn't always this smooth.
No. I mean, when we presented it, people look, if you're suggesting something at the right time, 90% of people think you're crazy, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like when I went back and did a master's in public health, nearly every orthopedic surgeon told me I was wasting my time. Orthopedics was scoping knees and doing, total shoulder replacements. And who cared about, business or geographic variation or best practices in orthopedics, right? And now every academic department has people in public health in their orthopedic departments. But when we sat down with US Lacrosse and approached the healthcare system, it was probably strong personalities that drove it over the finish line initially, rather than people going, oh, I get it. But their CEO and president, Steve Stenderson, we had been on a trip out to USA Ski and Snowboard as part of the planning. And we sat down with their leadership, and they had performance directly inside of their administrative headquarters. And we were talking, and again, it just made so much sense. This CEO and president of US Ski and Snowboard said, people want to see the athletes. They have to come see us, but they want to see the athletes. They want to see the sport. And it has really enabled. They have a full-size championship field out there. Many of the national teams practice and play. Like I say, 250 events, and that might be the NCAA champion playing one of the national teams. It could be high school championships. And I think, wonderfully, it could be inner city teams playing up there. It could be local rec teams playing. They've been very good partners with the county and city.
I think something interesting that's also come of this is we have athletes that they play on that field. They get hurt. They go to your office. They have surgery. They come to us, we rehab them, get them back to playing, then they get interested in the field, and then they come back and do observation hours with us and then go to PT school. So it's really cool to see this whole like lifespan of an athlete from playing all
well,
the way to...
Well, it's also, as you've been part of, it's the best of how medicine and sports medicine has to work, right? I mean, we used to have a bunch of partnerships with organizations and colleges, and all we did in the partnership was take care of their Division I athletes. That was it. We go on the campus, take care of the kids, leave the campus. And now you're teaching in their academic programs. You're taking care of their recreational athletes, their club athletes, their campus. You are working jointly, like with Towson University, we have a deep partnership, and USA Lacrosse, when the World Women's Lacrosse Championships were here, that they were on the Towson campus, we partnered with them, we partnered with USA Lacrosse, and everything went just much smoother because of those interconnected things in sports medicine. But that is, as the medical director for the sports program, my mantra is not more partnerships, but more deeply integrated partnerships. And then the next layer is integrating the partners that you have together, right? So, and then you can really have a big outsized impact that you wouldn't be able to have by yourself, even as a big healthcare system.
What do you envision would be like even the next step up from where we are? What could we do better than what we're doing right now?
Yeah, I would tell you, I've got an answer for that because, the corporate boss, we're very lucky. I answered directly to Steve Evans, the CMO of MedStar Health. He's the lead doctor. He took a big interest in sports. And fortunately, Wemi Dewogi, who is my like-minded person in the South, answered directly to him. And that's the kind of question we get at our quarterly meetings. I would say right now that MedStar Health has done a wonderful job at providing the following. Musculoskeletal care, both non-operative and operative. Organizational partnerships and emergency action planning that really cast a blanket around our organizational partnerships of best practices about emergency on-field care. So I think we do those things well. And then not just because you're a part of this, because you've heard me tell others this, the strongest point of the sports medicine program is the physical therapy and athletic training network that, you know, John Brickley set up, or many have contributed. But the physical therapists and the athletic trainers here, you know, they're all working at absolute top of licensure, right? I mean, out at USA Lacrosse, Kelly Lohr is an athletic trainer, but people at US Lacrosse, she's a mid to upper level administrator in HIPAA compliant databases, in tracking biometrics for the national teams, of interviewing for a slot. So physical therapy and athletic training, it's exceedingly good. So that's what we do great. What we have not done great yet is trying to figure out the wellness component. So in Baltimore right now, and MedStar is in Baltimore, so we're part of this, there's nowhere for an athlete to go get his VO2 max checked. We have a hard time within a $7 billion healthcare system knowing where to send young athletes for nutritional advice, where to send obese teenagers for pediatric specific obesity advice, or where to send our total joint patients whose BMIs are too high. We need to develop a platform that is economically sound, which is hard to do, for strength and conditioning services. We have a wonderful leader there, Jay Dyer. He has a number of people working for him. He and his group have worked with all the national teams out at USA Lacrosse. But again, it's been a victory of personality and perseverance over platform. So every healthcare system struggles with how do you make strength and conditioning services financially viable. We need more attention and more sports-specific people in mental health, both from a performance standpoint, but a overuse, mental overuse standpoint. And I would like to see our primary care sports medicine providers each developing niches in non-operative medical areas like obesity medicine, as we talked about, like pulmonary medicine. Again, if you're an asthmatic here in town, you need some special care, where do you go? Diabetes and exercise, orthobiologics, and really having a evidence-based, scientific-based approach to orthobiologics. A terribly interesting field where we should be leading with skepticism, not leading with direct to patient marketing that has completely gotten out of hand, and being a responsible voice in this area of trying to explain to patients the difference between the promise of biologics and the practical applications of biologics. So those are the things I think we do well, and the areas that we need to grow into. As with any other business, the problem areas to grow into are the ones that require unique and different financial platforms.
Love it. I know we could talk about this for the whole session or the whole episode. I don't want to skip out on the lacrosse part of it, getting back to the lacrosse athlete.
Sure.
So I'd love to hear from your perspective as an orthopedic surgeon, what are your concerns for the lacrosse athlete, and what are you seeing in your clinic from that standpoint?
Right. I guess, you know, uniquely for me, I mean, as an orthopedic surgeon, I try to always look at things as a team physician or an epidemiologist. And the very things we were talking about, and that's what people need to understand about culture and sport injuries, right? Because culture completely drives the injuries you see in sport. So not to get off, we will come back to lacrosse. But and the mid-80s, you know, Ronald Reagan, good or bad, I'm not saying good or bad, got up in a press conference and said the worst 9 words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." And people were at a place in America that they bought into that, right? But people forgot that scholastic sports are funded by the government. Recreational sports are funded by the government. So when the funding went out of rec sports and went out of scholastic and school-based sport, then the market filled that void. The club market filled the void. Well, not everybody can afford to play club sport. The club industry has convinced parents that their kids have to play a single sport 12 months out of the year, astronomically driving up injury rates because of the year-round play in a single sport, because your mechanics are different, but more importantly, because such a higher percentage of time in the club environment is spent in competitive game situations. And if you look at the High School Federation database, you look at the NCAA database, you look at the NFL database, injuries in game situations, two and a half to three and a half times higher than in practice. So I see injury rates going up and occurring at earlier ages in lacrosse because more kids are playing lacrosse only, and they're playing the same sport 12 months out of the year and at a highly competitive rate. And the secondary gain issues force children back before they're completely rehabbed. So those social things are important. The other thing that's interesting, particularly about lacrosse, if your audience I'm sure knows, a single sport with many different disciplines, right? Even the field game. So the men's field game and the women's field game, both field games, historically the men's have won a purposeful, unbridled contact, and the women's one of incidental contact. The men's and women's field games are coming closer and closer together. So we have legislated out the unprotected hit from an unknown distance in the men's game. You just can't whale on an unprotected player. That was based on epidemiology done out of this partnership and with U.S. lacrosse that showed most men's concussions and major injuries occurred when they were focused in a ground ball situation on the ball and not on their self-protection. And that many injuries occurred when kids were just, you know, you could used to run from 5 yards away and just unload on somebody. So, but the women's game now, because of many good reasons, it is the big success story of Title IX in college sports. Astronomic growth at the college level. It is the sport in America that has the highest transition from being able to play at high school level to being able to play on a collegiate team. Bigger, faster, stronger athletes. Coaches and officials allowing more contact than the rules would suggest, but with a physical athlete that is ready for some of that contact. So, a good example, concussions in lacrosse, one of the major issues that USA Lacrosse has worked on. The public looks at National High School Federation, MedStar, when we work with them. So it used to be that the women's game did not have any head protection, no goggles, no helmet. The men's game had what used to be a strapped helmet with a face mask and then turned to a hard shell helmet with a face mask. So the public was crying, just put women in men's helmets and let them play men's lacrosse, right? Well, the overall injury rates were significantly higher in men's lacrosse than they were in women's lacrosse. So the injury rates were going to go up. And interestingly, the mechanism of concussion in the men's game and the women's game is different. Body-to-body contact in the men's game, inadvertent stick and ball contact, primarily stick contact in the women's game. That was the data 10 years ago. Now, interestingly, if you look at the data, concussions now are slightly higher in the women's game than the men's game. There is still a larger proportion of the mechanism of the concussion being related to inadvertent stick-to-head contact. But the amount of concussions related to body contact is going up because the game is getting more physical. There is an ASTM certified women's specific headgear that is now available, that is being adopted at some scholastic programs. And it is a voluntary use. It is not mandatory use in the women's game, but I think it will grow. And it is aimed at primarily decreasing stick and ball issues. The men's helmet, just like a football helmet, there is no place anywhere in the world that any statement can be made that the men's lacrosse helmet decreases concussions. It is there to prevent facial lacerations, orbit fractures, contusions. Most of our concussions are body to body, not body to head contact from coup contra coup. And the, just like in football, the helmet does not do away with that. Another big issue that's been a wonderful success story is commotio cordis. So sudden cardiac death, mostly seen in young male lacrosse players based primarily on their musculature and their mechanical characteristics of their chest. But 15, 20 years ago, two or three young lacrosse players died every year. And the response was horrible, but just part of the game. That was it. That was the response. Luis Acampora was a young lacrosse player up on Long Island, died. His family committed time, energy, resources, money to educating the public. That was done, again, hand in hand with USA Lacrosse. And it has been a wonderful story about making AEDs available at most, if not all, can't say all, but most lacrosse competitions involving young boys. The design of shoulder pads now has a drop chest leaf that after a lot of sort of biomechanical investigation, also funded by U.S. Lacrosse and in part by MedStar Health with Link, Dr. Link and others, have come up with a fairly game appropriate chest protection that is really decreasing absorbing that energy or changing the energy so that it's not applied to the chest, hitting the chest at a particular time in the cardiac rhythm to cause ventricular fibrillation. But as you know, there we've had stories here in time where a young scholastic lacrosse player went down, and fortunately because of him, and it goes back to what you were saying, there wasn't one thing that saved the kid's life. They had an emergency action plan. They had practiced the action plan. There were health professionals on the field. There was an AED on the field. So that came out as a positive story. One of the hot issues now in lacrosse, again, not in men's lacrosse, because it has to do with the different mechanisms of shooting. If you asked me 10 years ago, what was the defining injury in lacrosse that you only see in lacrosse? I would have said it was a split distal phalanx fracture of the thumb in goalies from getting hit on the tip of their thumbs in gloves that they had modified. You don't see that fracture anywhere else. Now it's common in other sports, but very common in lacrosse now is stress fractures in the pars, so spondylolisthesis, spondylolysis.
And we actually, not to interrupt, but we actually, Dr. Kalantar is doing a whole episode on that.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So I won't steal thunder, but it's the reason it's interesting, if you're going to prevent it, you got to get out of the orthopedic box, right? Because it's an overuse injury. It's an overuse injury because kids are not strength conditioning and wellness in an efficient manner. You don't need 1,000 shots to be a better shooter. You need 200 shots in a scientific way of practice that are duplicating game environments and game demands. Because many of these kids that have pars fractures, because they're shooting 1,000 shots in their backyard every day, they get in a game situation and they have no transfer of that skill set. Less practice, better practice, more intelligent practice. And then it has to do with conditioning, right? Rotational strength. You see it in cricket bowlers, you see it in other athletes, but it's, you know, it's the crank, acceleration, deceleration, rotation, flexion, that's the problem. But it's fascinating because we will not solve this problem until parents understand that their young teenage boys are practicing lacrosse the wrong way and to some degree for the wrong reasons.
So, how do we translate that message to the athlete? Because I have treated many athletes who have had PAR stress reaction, and they're the ones that tell me they were on the field shooting hundreds and hundreds of shots. So how do we disseminate that message to say, like, hey, like, more is not better?
Yeah, I mean, it's a cultural change, right? I mean, because all of these kids are lining up to go to D1 programs. There are only so many D1 spots, and families need to understand. I mean, I've covered the best college lacrosse in America, and 40 kids on a team, they only have 15 scholarships, right? So I don't care how good your child is. If boys or girls, women's lacrosse at the collegiate level, everybody's a partial scholarship. Then you get down to the D3 level. And look, a lot of D3 schools have taken the financial platform now that they've got 65 kids on their college lacrosse team, all paying full boat to come play lacrosse, right? So one is that the young people will have to hear it from their people they look up to, their strength and conditioning people, their lacrosse heroes. So I think the best thing for us to do is to educate the influencers in lacrosse, be that the college faces that people know, the professional faces in the men's and women's league that people know, the coaches that people know, because they are the people that can influence the kids. And most of that group understands the benefit of medical education and advice. So I don't think we win as the healthcare providers trying to educate the kids. I think we educate the influencers and then they educate the kids. And I'm going to give you another great example in NFL. We educate the coaches to understand that it is the entire organization's priority number one to have healthy, high-performing athletes. And I didn't say lacrosse players. Healthy, high-performing athletes. Because if you don't have a healthy, happy, high-performing athlete, you're not going to get a good lacrosse player. So a few years ago, Alan Sills took over the CMO job at the NFL. Alan and I were classmates at Hopkins, and I've been fortunate enough for him to ask me to help co-chair their Research and Innovations Committee. But Alan took the NFL from sort of a backwoods injury epidemiology, injury prevention organization to one of the best public health organizations in the country. A lot of the COVID data and stuff that came out of how long you have to be in a room, it came from the NFL. But what they have found is that with all of the injury data they can gather, it used to be proprietary to one team. Like Team A in Seattle would go, all of my training data, I'm not letting anybody else see it, my injuries, my training tech. No. Well, Al said, everybody's got to share the data. And if you can get smart people, that's on you to use the data better. But what it has shown and what we've been able to do is that the coaching staffs are now the first people coming to listen to health-related education. Because they understand if they lose one player out of 52, and it's the right player with a hamstring injury done for the year, their check's going down, right? So they've got the value add of healthcare. And if you can get NFL coaches to buy into that, we have to get lacrosse coaches at every level to buy into that.
Yeah. Getting back to injuries a little bit, big thing that we see in the clinic are ACL tears. Sure. And this sort of ties into early specialization, playing too often, more injuries. We see a lot of ACL tears in our clinic. What is it like for you seeing these athletes? I treated a 9-year-old that you treated from 9 years old and then going up to their career, collegiate career, becoming an adult, a human, retiring from sport. Do you worry about the health of their joints seeing them
so young. Well, worry about the health of their joints and their, you know, and
I know, I know you care about mental. The whole human too, but.
Right. So, I mean, the interesting thing is this, is that, and we've talked about this in other forums, humans are built to be efficient mid-distance runners. They're not built to be efficient jump cut, twist, turn. For us to walk efficiently, we have to have a bend in our knee, a valgus knee. That valgus knee puts us at risk for ACL injuries and patella dislocations disproportionately. The group that is the hardest to work with is not the college athlete, never had any problems, high energy, normal anatomy, maybe, you know, slight, as we also talked about, people think ACLs are mostly non-contact. Well, maybe not physical contact, but nearly all of them had to do with some perturbation in your environment that you're not ready to adjust to. And then you tear your ACL because you didn't set, you didn't load, you didn't anticipate. And we can work with all of those things. But the group that is just so hard are the 12, 13, 14-year-olds who have their entire lives wrapped up with their lacrosse participation and tear their ACL when they're 12 or 13, because that is a life-altering injury. The 20-year-old tearing their ACL is bad, but they often will get back because they've already gotten to that level of play where they have a chassis that enables that, and that chassis that enables that also helps decrease their risk, and it's as simple as being a better spring. Absorbing energy from your environment and releasing it to your environment. And these 12 and 13 and 14-year-olds don't have that ability. They tear their ACL, they tear a meniscus pad. And because parents and children only hear about their idols, they look at the college and professional player who had the ACL and then were back playing in 8 months productively. They don't understand it's a 12-year process. And I have some smart friends in sports medicine around the country that look at the data and go, if your 12, 13, 14-year-old tears their ACL in a field sport, they should not go back to that sport. They need to do something different. Now, I'm not saying that because I think with great physical therapists like yourself and athletic training and an appropriate program, you have to convince the athlete and the family you got to be a better spring. So it's not about rehabbing your knee. It is about you being a better spring before you go back. So I do a lot of pediatric ACLs. Next week, I've got a 12-year-old and a 9-year-old on the schedule. You have to do those surgeries in ways that respect their growth plates. 10 years ago, they would have gone to an orthopedic surgeon and their answer would have been, well, stop playing sports until you're done growing, right? And you can keep kids out of organized sports, but you can't keep them from playing on their own. So then the kids came back, they torn their meniscus, they had horrible arthritis. So much more aggressive in young people. We can do the surgery in ways that avoid the growth plates, avoid wrist, leg length discrepancy, and angular deformity. But what we're not doing is changing their immature risk factors as far as their platform of their muscular skeletal chassis. ACL reconstruction, we're getting smarter and dumber all the time in that the harder we look and the more research we do and the more we follow our patients, the more we understand that many of them aren't doing as well as we thought because we used to didn't follow them. One of the two interesting areas in ACL reconstruction now are ACL repair. Again, got out of the gate, got a lot of attention. There is a small niche of people who tear their ACLs that are appropriate for repair. And that has to be almost an avulsion type injury where the ligament's pulled off, the ligament tissue and health is good, and we can repair it. Another is trying to decrease injury rates by accessory surgical procedures, typically on the outside of the knee, either using the central part of the iliotibial band or a separate hamstring autoallograft to reconstruct the anterior lateral ligament, which is a small anatomic structure, sort of runs from Gerty's tubercle up to the lateral epicondyle that helps control rotation, excessive rotation. So we think that with high risk athletes, these young athletes, or if it's a revision situation, or if you're hyperlax, adding that augmented procedure, which interestingly, 25, 30 years ago, that was the surgery that was done for ACL deficient knees, was an extra articular restricted procedure. So what goes around comes around. And then there's this whole area too, not so much in lacrosse because it is such a demanded jump cut, twist, turn, change of direction, but defining who's copers. I mean, who might not have to have an ACL reconstruction based on their underlying risk factors and the environment that they're going to go back to. Lacrosse is particularly hard with ACLs, right? Because it is the epitome of jump cut, twist, turn, change of direction, you know, just a lot of rotational energy going through your knees. Now, if you look at the lacrosse data, it's the same as the NFL and soccer now. The priority, the major time loss injury is hamstring injuries and adductor strains. Because they're common and they can be devastating, then ACLs, then concussions, because everybody's focused on concussions so hard. Most concussions come back to play within a relatively short period of time and don't entail a lot of game and practice loss. You tear your ACL, you're out of competitive play a minimum of 8 to 12 months, and it takes you another season to get back. You have a bad adductor, bad hamstring tear, it can haunt you the rest of your career. So, and the prevention for hamstring and adductor, they happen more in preseason than they do in midseason. So it has to do with the effect of load in early practices and how do you let athletes gradually get used to that rather than having big jumps in activity.
I could listen to you talk all day.
Well, I like talking, obviously. So, you know, it's fun. I was looking forward to being here, and I knew you'd ask some good questions. We see the world a lot alike, so it's good. It's good seeing you, and it's good talking to you.
Well, I'm not done yet. I was saying, like, I'm saying we could go on for hours talking about this. So I feel bad because we're not going into super detail and a lot of things. I feel I'm definitely going to bring you back to talk about pediatric ACL surgery for a later one this year, if you're open to that.
Right. Sure.
Is there any message you want to leave to physical therapists, PT students, rehab professionals listening to this with regards to lacrosse medicine? And I don't know, the floor is yours.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing I say at the end of every, and I still talk to physical therapists and athletic trainers a lot. It's the same thing I tell everybody right before I leave. You can be as smart as you want to be. Where you work is completely different than when I worked as a PT and an ATC. There was a definite ceiling about what you could do, where you could go, who you could hang out with in the educational forum. In my career, sports medicine has changed from being led by singular individuals to being led by teams, by athletes and athletic organizations really not knowing or caring what letters are behind your name as long as you seem to be value-added and are advancing their agenda in safety, wellness, and performance. So, as an athletic trainer or a physical therapist, you can be taking care of the performance data for a professional league team. You can be traveling and doing wellness for organizations or individual athletes. I hope and think within our system that we're a great example of PTs and ATCs leading multidimensional disciplinary organizations, both educationally and clinically. So, if I could do what y'all can do now, I might still be doing it. But 30 years ago, there was just a ceiling that you weren't going to get any higher about, right? So I think that's the biggest thing is you can do what you want to do, but people will immediately sniff you out. And I tell my fellows this, and well, what's the one thing you're going to learn coming here for the year? I say you're going to have a high volume of clinic care. You're going to have a high volume of bread and butter surgery. You're going to see some of the intricate things, but when you leave here, you will have been in athletes' environments, on the field, in the training room, in the locker room, in their business, and they will know whether you are a sports person or not. Immediately, people will sniff you out immediately, and they'll go, does this person know what they're talking about? Are they going to help me? Are they sure of themselves? And we got great examples all through the system of PTs and ATCs that do that. And we all have examples of people who have not taken advantage of that, right? Because if you want it to just still be a job, it can still just be a job rather than being a profession. So,
absolutely. Dr. Hinton, we love to end our episodes finding out either your favorite quote or best advice you've ever been given. What is yours?
Damn. I have a little framed piece of paper on my on my desk at work. And you can't read the ink, but you can see the impression of the pen on the paper. And just a little sniff of it having been a red pen. But you can't read the ink. You have to get up close to it. And it's an impression on a piece of paper. And when I was cleaning out my grandmother's house after she died, I took it off of her bulletin board. And it says, be patient with yourself. So that's what I'd say.
I think we all need to show ourselves a little more self-compassion, more patience with ourselves. Absolutely. I love it. Thank you for sharing that. Dr. Hinton, where can people find you? Where are you treating out of?
I'm sort of, most of my clinic time is up in Hunt Valley at the USA Lacrosse facility. But I'm also, I see patients in Timonium. I see patients in Bel Air. You got athletes, particularly young athletes, they need to be seen. Just pick up the phone and call my office. I'm happy to see them anytime. And also very happy to proactively from you all hear about my patients, talk about the patients. So I'm always about that exchange of ideas. So, and that's what works good about at USA Lacrosse, right? In our better facilities, you can walk down the hall, you can share in the same physical space, but we can do that virtually as well.
Definitely. Dr. Hinton, thank you so much for your time. It's been awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for the invitation. Okay.
Yeah.
Have a good one. All right.
Thanks,
Buck.
Thanks for listening to the Let's Get Physical Therapy podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram at MedStarHealthPT. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please give us a 5-star rating and leave a review so we can reach more listeners just like you. As always, we appreciate your time and hope you join us for our next episode.